So I took this tiny little bush plane, I think there were six of us on it, up. It's about an hour and a half flight from Fairbanks up to the village that I was visiting, which is called Kaktovik. And it's on this tiny little island just off the northern coast of Alaska, so it's sort of surrounded by the Arctic Ocean. And it was really fascinating on the plane because you could see the landscape change as you sort of cross the tree line, and all of a sudden there's no more trees and there's just these kind of vast open kind of wastelands, the Yukon Flats, with these huge strange kind of pools of water that were frozen at that point. It kind of looked like the surface of the moon a bit. And then you carry on a bit further and you cross the Brooks Range, which is this massive mountain range that goes quite a long way down North America. And they're all covered in snow and ice, and they've got these beautiful glaciers going through them. They're all kind of sparkling blue. So you fly over the Brooks Range for absolutely ages. And then I was like really, really looking to see when the Arctic Ocean was starting, because obviously everything's white and the Arctic Ocean is frozen, and it was really hard to see where the land ended and the ocean began. But yeah, finally we were flying over the Arctic Ocean, and I was expecting to land any minute, but we didn't seem to be landing, and I was looking for the village and I couldn't see it. And then the pilot said, sorry about this, we lost the village, we couldn't find it, so we've got plenty of fuel, don't worry. So we're just going to circle for a bit, circled for quite a long time. So it was really interesting because obviously at that point, this is April, the Arctic Ocean is totally frozen. But the weather had just changed and it just started getting warm for the first time really. So you could see these giant fault lines in the sea ice where it was starting to open up. It went on for miles, and you could see a few areas of open water with icebergs floating in them, sort of in this vast expanse of white. So that was really interesting because I knew that that's very, very early for the sea ice to be melting at that far south. So that was my first indication really that the climate change that I'd heard so much about was happening. That's the first time I actually saw it with my own eyes.
You're listening to the 300 to 350 show, and this is the first of two episodes featuring Jess Worth, a co-editor of New Internationalist, who has recently finished editing an issue of the magazine focusing on the Arctic, which uncovers the largely untold story of how climate change is impacting already on the indigenous peoples and their traditional subsistence lifestyles. Indigenous peoples are not just victims in the climate change story, they're also proactive in fighting back against fossil fuel developments on their lands, which impact them directly through local pollution and oil spills, and indirectly through their contribution to climate change. A recent string of successful legal challenges suggests that indigenous peoples could end up playing a critical role in the fight against climate change. In part two, we'll look at the Arctic central position in the climate tipping point story, and the historic International Indigenous Peoples Summit on Climate Change, and its implications for the UN climate talks in Copenhagen at the end of the year, as well as the rush to exploit the fossil fuel resources in the Arctic opened up by the sea ice melt.
So I spent a few days in this village, and it's a village of about 300 people. It's on an island that's been used as a trading post by indigenous people for about 10,000 years. So they've got a really long history there, and they've been hunting in that area for a long time as well. And like certainly all of the indigenous communities in northern Alaska and most of the indigenous communities across the Arctic, they still live a subsistence lifestyle. So hunting and gathering is a really, really important source of food, and it's really important to their culture and their identity and so on. But they also are more connected to the Western world than they ever have been before. So it was this strange mixture of, you know, going out and hunting the same herds of animals and the same shoals of fish and so on that they've hunted for generations, but doing it on snowmobiles with GPS, you know, to help them navigate, which is, you know, very new, or you know, motorboats and so on. So, you know, and lots of them have got cable in their cabins now. So it's this really interesting mix of old and new. And the more time I spent there and the more people I spoke to, the more I realised that climate change is affecting their lives in lots of different ways, and they might seem quite subtle, but their implications are quite devastating. So, for example, it's changing the migratory patterns of the animals that they're used to hunting. So there's this massive caribou herd called the porcupine caribou herd, and the whole herd, sort of tens of thousands of caribou, all come to the coastal plain where the village is located to birth every summer. And so that's a really important source of food for them. And the hunting period is so short, because it's so cold most of the time that there aren't any animals around, that it's really important that they know where the caribou are going to be and when. And they always have known that, because they've been hunting them for years. And all of a sudden, they're not sure anymore. The caribou are coming down earlier, or they're coming down later. They're not in the mountains when they should be. So that's really affecting the rhythm of life and their ability to get the food that they traditionally rely upon. There's also worrying levels of starvation in the caribou herd, because in the winter now, rather than snow, they're sometimes getting freezing rain, which freezes onto the surface of the snow, which makes it really difficult to walk on if you've got hooves like a caribou. So they can't travel the distances that they used to. But also it freezes over the lichen on the trees and on the bushes that they live on, so they're also not able to get as much food. Then one of the things that Kaktovik is famous for is that they are traditionally a whaling community. So they take maybe two whales from the sea in the summer and then share it out amongst the whole community, and that basically keeps them going for the whole winter. And what they do once they've taken the meat is they dump the whale bones right at the edge of the island, and that coincides with the time when polar bears are at their hungriest, because they've been stuck on land in the summer waiting for the sea ice to reform so they can go back out and hunt seals. So they eat loads of seals over the winter, get really, really fat, and then sort of live off that for the summer before they can get back onto the sea ice. So polar bears know that these whale carcasses are going to be dumped just at the time when they're really hungry, and they come from miles around and feast on it and then just hang out near the village. And it works for the villagers because it keeps the bears out of the village. It stops them coming in and scavenging, so it keeps them safer. But it also means that lots of people come to the village to watch the bears, because they've got plenty of food, so they're really chilled out, and you can just watch them play and almost walk among them. And the villagers have noticed a really sharp drop-off of the numbers of polar bears that are coming every year. You know, they're losing 10, 15 out of maybe 30 that they'll have over the winter every year. And also they're noticing that more of the bears that are coming are much smaller, much less well-fed, much less healthy-looking. And they've also had, this winter just gone, they had a few bears coming into the village at totally the wrong time when they should be out on the sea ice, attacking people's dogs because they were so desperately hungry. So they had to be shot, because there's not a lot you can do to shoo away a starving polar bear. And that's all to do with the sea ice retreating and the polar bears losing their habitat. Another thing that I saw just walking through the village with Bruce, who was the guy that guided me while I was out there, and I could see that there were a few caribou carcasses just lying out on the snow. And I knew that a lot of people from the village had been up in the mountains hunting that week. So I kind of said, oh, have some people just got back from a hunt? And he said, no, 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 they're last year's food. And basically what they do, because they have such a, like I said, such a small hunting window, they tend to catch all of their food for the year in the space of about 3 months. And then they dig big permafrost freezers, essentially, into the permafrost, store all the food in there, and then that keeps them going for the winter. But because the permafrost is thawing, then all of a sudden that system isn't working anymore. So they'd had to take all the food out and find other ways of storing it. And if you think about having to fit that much food, essentially two whales and a load of caribou, into electricity powered freezer for a whole winter, it's just not possible. So because they're not able to use these traditional methods anymore, they're being forced to import more food, which is really expensive, because, you know, it all has to be flown up there. But also there's a whole kind of epidemic of obesity and diabetes spreading through the indigenous population of Alaska and Canada as well, because they're eating this processed food that's not good for them and that their bodies aren't used to. So a lot of people might assume that the people of the Arctic would be winners from climate change because it will get warmer, and surely that's a good thing. It must be horrible living up in such a cold place. But that's actually not what's happening at all. It's the other way around. Their very way of life is under threat, and there doesn't seem to be an awful lot that they can do about it.
And elsewhere on the Alaskan coast, there are a couple of villages that are threatened physically in a very immediate way.
It's not just in Alaska, it's actually happening across the Arctic coast and Canadian coastline as well, and I'm sure it's happening in Russia as well, that essentially villages that live on the very edge of the land, on the edge of the Arctic Ocean, three things are happening. One is that the sea ice that has always been there to perform a protective barrier, particularly in the winter when the storms are at their most violent, as that is receding very rapidly, as it has been over the last 10 years, that protective barrier isn't there anymore. And then secondly, as we know, climate change is causing more extreme weather events, and so the storms have been getting worse. So the Arctic coastline has been really battered in the last few years by storms, and it's causing really dramatic coastal erosion in various places. And because Arctic indigenous peoples, many of them have a sort of hunting and fishing tradition, so many of the villages are right on the very coastline, so they can be as close to the water as possible because that's where they get a lot of their food. So they're really on the front line. And then the third thing that's happening is that as the big glaciers are melting on the mainland, and this is particularly the case in Canada as I understand it, the land is lifting up as there's less pressure on it. So it's lifting up in the middle and it's going down at the sides. So as well as rising sea level, you've actually got sinking land as well. So the combination of lack of sea ice, worse weather events and sinking land means that all of a sudden there are several villages that really can't survive very much longer in their current location. So I interviewed a man called Tony Wayuama, and he's from a village called Shishmaref, and they're widely regarded as one of the world's first climate refugee villages, in that the community voted a few years ago to relocate the entire village because they've literally been losing metres off their coastline in really bad storms. Some people's homes have gone into the sea, others have had to be lifted and moved to another part of the island because they're about to go into the sea. It's just not viable for the community to stay there very much longer. So I think it was a very painful decision for them to move because, again, they've been there for 10,000 years. But they decided that they ought to be able to find a place to relocate that was still in the same area. So they would still be able to hunt a lot of the same animals, and they wouldn't be going too far away. So, you know, their traditions and identity wouldn't be affected too badly. So then Tony was one of the people who was tasked with, first of all, finding an alternative location, which they found two or three relatively easily. And secondly, raising the funding to actually move. And that's been a real problem, because they're a subsistence community. They don't really have any alternative sources of income. So they don't have a cash income. And because they have a school and they have electricity and they have sanitation, and it's quite a big village, it's 600 people, then to relocate the village will cost $100 million, more or less, which they don't even begin to have. So they need to get that money from somewhere. So they've spent the last maybe 5 years trying to get this $100 million. They've approached the Alaska state and haven't managed to get the money from them. They've approached the US federal government and haven't managed to get the money from them. They've tried to approach the UN, but because the US hasn't signed up to the Kyoto Protocol, they're not eligible for adaptation funding. And anyway, governments aren't actually giving those funds yet, even though they keep promising that they're going to. And even if the governments do give the funds, is it really going to go towards a community in a so-called developed country that actually the adaptation and mitigation funds are intended for developing countries? They've courted the international media in the hopes that that will raise their profile and put a bit more pressure on their government, but that doesn't seem to have had an effect. So they're basically stuck. And what's also happened is that because they've taken the decision to move, even though they haven't got the funding to move, the government has now said, right, well, we're not going to invest in fortifications and improvements to your existing village to try and stave off the worst of the future erosion. So they're also not eligible for that anymore. So I had a really long conversation with Tony about what his options were, and he was kind of saying, well, maybe we need to go to Europe, or maybe we need to go to trusts and foundations, because we've basically run out of options. He was hoping that the Obama administration will be a bit more friendly towards them, but actually, since Obama got in, Congress have overturned a ruling that had formally been made saying that the US government does have an obligation to help communities affected by climate change relocate. So it seems to have gone even more in the wrong direction since Obama got in, although I don't know whether he had anything directly to do with that. It was Congress. And this is a really huge issue because Shishmaref is just the first of many, many, many communities, particularly poor, vulnerable communities, who are going to have to relocate due to climate change. And we need to come up with some kind of a system that will allow them to get the funding in order to do that. And it can't be done on a case-by-case basis with each community having to start from scratch and fight this huge fight and put enormous amounts of resources and time and energy into it, because there's just going to be too many of them. So I think this is something that Copenhagen will definitely have failed if they don't come up with some kind of structure and some kind of source of funding on a large enough scale to help these communities who essentially have contributed practically nothing to climate change, but whose lives are being completely destroyed because of it.
I mean, like you say, in a sense, the US itself should have sufficient funding to be able to provide for its own people. Mm. And did this former legislation that's now been overturned, was that before or after Katrina, do you know?
It was after. It was something that Tony had been involved in lobbying for.
Right.
I mean, I think it might be partly to do with the fact that they're in Alaska, and Alaska's quite out of sight, out of mind for the rest of the US. They sort of don't really see it as part of the same country, really, apart from, you know, being very grateful for all the oil revenue that they get from it. I think it's partly to do with the fact that Sarah Palin is governor of Alaska, or was until a few days ago, and is not at all sympathetic to these kinds of things. It's partly to do with not wanting to open the floodgates, recognising that once you agree to give funding to one community, then there's probably another 12 that actually are going to have to relocate in the next 10, 15 years. So they're all immediately going to then come in and also ask for the funding. And it's also just not having caught up with the reality, the speed of climate change yet. I think, you know, politicians and the political establishment and political mechanisms are nowhere near able to deal with the implications of climate change. They're way behind.
They need to be shamed into action, don't they, the Obama administration?
Mm, yeah, and I think it's also to do with the fact that they're indigenous people who are seen as second-class citizens and have precious few rights as it is, and so they are the people least likely to get their voices heard, really.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Way up on the northwest coast of Alaska, the village of Kivalina is piling sandbags against a rising sea. Villagers say it's climate change, and they've filed papers suing top U.S. energy companies for damages. Two of the country's top trial attorneys, who squared off on opposite sides of an epic big tobacco suit decades ago, are this time lined up together for Kivalina and against ExxonMobil, Chevron, and a whole lot more. This hour, On Point, going after after big energy for global warming, the courts, and climate change.
I guess partly because they've watched Shishmaref try and fail to get statutory funding for their relocation. Another village that's just a little bit up the coast have tried a different approach. They are actually suing Exxon Mobil and I think it's 28 other fossil fuel companies for their role in causing climate change, and they're hoping that the money that they would win in damages will actually pay for the relocation of the village. It's a pretty kind of cheeky, gutsy, some might say desperate approach, but you can see why they've done it, because where else are they supposed to get
to the people that are responsible?
Going directly to source, they're going to the people that have profited from causing this climate change, and they have a very strong case in that not only have these oil companies clearly been part of causing the problems or the reason why they have to relocate in the first place, but part of their case is they've targeted the companies that have funded climate change deniers and who have lobbied against effective action on climate change. So I think, you know, you can make a very clear link between lack of action and lack of help for them and these specific companies. So the case has been heard and they're waiting for a ruling at the moment. If you want to get updates on it, they are being supported by the Native American Rights Foundation.
At the same time as being affected by climate change, Indigenous peoples in Alaska and elsewhere are having to fight against developments by fossil fuel companies. Mm. And there is a whole Indigenous organisation, Red Oil, I presume it's a coalition of quite dispersed populations, but they're providing backup for people with their local campaigns and having some successes.
Yeah, so Red Oil stands for Resisting Environmental Destruction on Indigenous Lands. And I spent quite a lot of time with the director, who's a woman called Faith Gemmel. I went to her office and she showed me on the wall, they've got this really huge map of Alaska. And I was kind of asking about, you know, what the different issues are for Indigenous people around the state. And she just took me round the map, almost community by community, and said, you know, this community is fighting a huge new coal mine, this community is fighting an oil platform out into the river, this community is still trying to recover from the Exxon Valdez disaster, and it's just all over the place. And what they do is they connect and support these communities, and they've taken quite a lot of legal action that's been actually really successful. So in that sense, I actually left Alaska with a feeling of hope that the tables are actually starting to turn, and I think it's got a lot to do with a kind of resurgence in fortunes and in political direction amongst Indigenous communities in North America who have just been utterly screwed over for so many years and are finally finding their feet again and getting organised, and we're really starting to see some results.
Have you managed to prevent any developments?
Yes. We've been in litigation on the Outer Continental Shelf issue, the OCS five-year plan. Mm-hmm. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in November that Shell cannot operate in the Beaufort Sea because they didn't consider the subsistence impacts. Mm-hmm. That was Shell Oil. We stopped Shell Oil in the Beaufort Sea.
Well done.
And we're also involved in litigation in the Chukchi Sea, where Lease Sale 193 would allow development in 30 million acres of the Chukchi Sea. Mm-hmm. That case is pending. But the native village of Point Hope recently had a victory. They are the community that has been very vocal in standing up and speaking out against and opposing Chukchi offshore development because that's their ocean. They call it their garden. They were in the lawsuit that we just won 3 days ago in the District of Columbia that stated that the whole five-year plan, OCS plan of the U.S. government is illegal. So we've been very successful.
Yeah, that's amazing.
We've been very successful in our efforts. We've brought in tribes, and tribal governments, and the tribal governments as sovereign governments have taken on and joined in these lawsuits and raised the issue of our subsistence way of life and the violations that are happening to the sovereign relationships we have with the U.S. government and to protect our subsistence way of life. So that's why it's been successful.
Yeah.
Every single court case has stated that the subsistence way of life of the local people has not been considered.
Mm-hmm.
We were also part of the litigation where we took the EPA to the Supreme Court through Massachusetts versus EPA.
Mm-hmm.
We were friends of the court,
mm-hmm.
along with other tribal governments here in the state of Alaska. Red Oil was a friend of the court also, and we won that victory. And now it's up to the U.S. government to implement it,
mm-hmm.
and actually force the EPA. The EPA should regulate greenhouse gases.
Mm-hmm.
That was the purpose of that lawsuit, and we won in the Supreme
mm-hmm.
Court, but it still hasn't happened. We should not be allowing more fossil fuel expansion and development on new areas, anywhere in the U.S., anywhere in the world, because look at what's happening to our climate from all of this development. It's human-induced. We're the ones that are creating this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are going to survive as humanity, we have to change how we live. That's the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
And my people have a prophecy about that. And our prophecy, it said we are not protecting these places for ourselves, like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It's for all humankind. And they told us to go out there and tell our story and tell them. We're not doing this for ourselves. We're doing it for all people. Because if that area is ever developed, it will start a cycle of destruction of humanity. And so that's why we defend that area. And if you listen to other indigenous peoples here, they all have the same prophecies. The same prophecies in their territories that come from their people that say the same thing. Humankind has to change what we're doing. We have no choice anymore. And right now we have the technology available to have clean, sustainable energy. It just doesn't make sense to me for them to continue to like go into new areas, to cut down more forests, to take more of the minerals from under our lands, and to continue to seek more fossil fuel development and continue to destroy and destabilize our natural environment. It doesn't make sense. Any child with common sense could see that.
Mm-hmm.